Those, 6,132, required immediate hospitalization. A total of 61 of them died within the next 3 months. Of these, 49 had been captured at Dien Bien Phu. For fear of arousing French public opinion, the extent of French losses at Dien Bien Phu has never been made public, but a simple computation makes it possible to arrive at a close estimate of the actual losses. From the foregoing, it is obvious that the losses on the Dien Bien Phu trek were probably far higher than those suffered by the prisoners captured in earlier engagements. By placing the returnee rate at a conservative one-third, including those captured since the beginning of the battle, it is possible to estimate that about 3,000 men, including the 885 directly repatriated from Dien Bien Phu, out of a total of 16,544, eventually returned from Dien Bien Phu. Over 3,000 died in the battlefield area, and a few hundred others, of whom more will be said later, disappeared in Eastern Europe. But the rest, close to 10,000 men, died on the trek or in the prison camps in less than 3 months' time. This is a hard statistical fact, which cannot and should not be overlooked. The Viet Minh clearly realized that the survivors of Dien Bien Phu constituted a choice prize in the sense that they had been the center of attention in the Western world for several months and also constituted the cream of the French army. The same was true for the native soldiers from northern and tropical Africa. Ideas planted now in the Viet Minh prison camps would have time to germinate later, once they had returned home. The noted French novelist and reporter Jean Lartigue gives an excellent account of the North Vietnamese brainwashing methods in his novel The Centurions. They made roughly two sets of converts, the North Africans, that is, mainly the Algerians, and the right-wing French junior officers. In the case of the Algerians, the reason was obvious. The French colonialists were in the process of losing the war in Indochina and would doubtless be incapable of resisting another anti-colonial rebellion. The argument used on the Algerians was devastatingly simple in its application. Once segregated from their leaders, the Algerian soldiers were congratulated by their captors for their heroic attitude during the battle. But the conclusion that was hammered into them, often by other Algerians or Moroccans who had been trained in Peking or who had been taken prisoner earlier, was, "And since you are such good soldiers, why do you fight for the colonialists? Why don't you fight for yourselves and get yourself a country of your own?" For the officers and non-commissioned officers of Algerian origin, the argument was somewhat more sophisticated because it was simply too potent to be effectively resisted. Almost 10 years later, a former Algerian prisoner, who had been captured not at Dien Bien Phu but elsewhere in North Vietnam, told me what made him change his opinion. "One colonial war was enough for us," he said. "The moral commitment between the colonial power and the colonized people was broken forever." In the French army in Indochina, the man had been a lieutenant. In newly independent Algeria, he was Lieutenant Colonel Sliman Hoffman, the director of the Algerian Ministry of Defense. Some of the North Africans volunteered to serve in the armed forces of their captors, but the Viet Minh politely refused. "We are victorious," they would say to the Algerians, "not because there are so many of us, but because we are fighting in our own country among our own people. We do not need Algerians to fight for Vietnam. You Algerians must fight in Algeria." The Algerians listened and learned. On November 1, 1954, the Algerian rebellion broke out. It was to last even longer than the Indochina War, and there would be no Dien Bien Phu. But the Algerians won anyway. Another group of prisoners was the subject of special attention, the Eastern Europeans. Contrary to the accepted myth that the Foreign Legion was made up largely of former SS troopers, many of the Foreign Legionnaires came from the Eastern European countries overrun by the Soviet armies in 1945. Since the average age of the Foreign Legionnaire was about 23 in 1954, most of them had been small boys in 1945. Many of the German Legionnaires had come originally from East German areas and now became the object of particular pressure by the Viet Minh political commissars to return to East Germany as walking propaganda exhibits. The Soviet Union admitted that foreign legionnaires of Eastern European nationality who had volunteered to return to Eastern Europe had been returned there by Soviet aircraft. In December 1954, after the repatriation of all French Union prisoners officially listed as such had long since been completed an organization of Eastern European exiles in New York issued a list of about 1,000 foreign legionnaires from Eastern European countries who had allegedly been compelled to return there. What their eventual fate was in their communist homelands is anyone's guess. A certain number of prisoners of French nationality who were known to be alive at the time of the ceasefire refused to return to their homeland, just as a handful of United States prisoners defected to communist China after the Korean War. But beyond a doubt, the most interesting victims of brainwashing were the staunchly Catholic and conservative junior officers of the French army. As far as they were concerned, their whole world, the whole code by which they had lived and fought, had crashed about them on the blood-soaked hills of Dien Bien Phu. They had fought as best they knew how. They were at least as well trained and far better equipped than their communist counterparts. Yet they had lost. When everything was said and done, it remained a fact that the anti-communist Vietnamese simply had not fought like the Vietnamese on the communist side. The non-communist guerrilla forces in the hills around Dien Bien Phu had not succeeded in cutting off or interfering with the Viet Minh supply lines as they were supposed to have done. Even the French troops, though they had fought honorably in many cases, had not, with the exception of the paratroop battalions, fought with the fanaticism of the enemy. Was it not General Navarre himself who, in his later memoirs, said of his own army that they were good and devoted men, but they were not exactly the soldiers of the French Revolution? Had not a senior officer from Dien Bien Phu been overheard to say in the prison camp that we were fighting for our professional honor and, in the end, for our skins, but they, the enemy, were fighting for their country? Obviously, there was something else to the war in Vietnam and the Battle of Dien Bien Phu than professional competence or an error in strategy on the part of General Navarre. That would give far too little credit to what every French officer had witnessed for himself 30 times over throughout the Battle of Dien Bien Phu, and what made an old army sergeant major like Abderrahman Ben Salem admire an enemy who made him walk over the dying bodies of his own men. It was that kind of fanaticism which the French resistance had possessed. The communists very willingly provided the answers to their captives' question. They were all contained in cheap-looking little booklets written in Chinese, but also published in English and French, and now laboriously retranslated into Vietnamese. They had mostly been written by a Chinese leader about whom most of the officers had hardly heard, even though they were fighting a war right next to his country, Mao Zedong. Others were written by the General Secretary of the Vietnamese Communist Party, Truong Chinh. They all dealt with one and the same subject, which they called revolutionary warfare. It was not, as the French officers had thought, simply a newer method of fighting small wars, and it had almost nothing to do with fighting as they knew it. But all those writings, just as the lectures of the political commissars to the prisoners, emphasized the importance of what they called the people, the huge mass of illiterate peasants from which their army was drawn. With a sort of horrified fascination, the French army officers watched the process work on the lesser motivated NCOs and particularly on the non-French soldiers among the prisoners. There was in fact little brutality, but there was a fantastic combination of repetitive assertion of certain half-truths combined with methodical rewards for lessons learned well and mild punishment for resistance to the learning process in the true Pavlov tradition. Maximum emphasis was on group learning and group discipline, since for every individual resistance to the learning process, the whole group was liable to such punishment as, say, withholding of quinine pills essential to resisting malaria, or of a mail distribution known to have arrived in the camp, or of the Red Cross packages that provided a slight improvement in the camp diet. There soon developed selective pressure by the prisoners themselves on the recalcitrants among them who refused to accept the common discipline. Those who proved to be totally unamenable to persuasion soon found themselves transferred to the ill-famed Lang Trong reprisal camp, from which no one ever returned. It was Father Jondel, a chaplain with the 6th BPC, who had been taken prisoner in 1952, who summed up the experience of indoctrination in one single but eloquent sentence. The worst wasn't to die, but to see one's soul change. It was this soul-changing which was to leave its most indelible mark on the French officers who survived Dien Bien Phu. Not that any of them became convinced that communism was the way of the future and that the West was philosophically inferior, but they were now firmly convinced that what was needed was the ruthless application of what one Soviet writer called the rape of the masses, and their deliberate and methodical conditioning for the revolutionary tasks ahead. Had there been a few years of respite between Vietnam and Algeria, these officers might have been able to digest their experience, but this was not to be the case. Within months after their liberation from the prison camps in Vietnam, they were plunged into yet another national liberation war in Algeria, a few hundred miles from home, and this time they believed they were playing the game for keeps. With cold ferocity, both the Algerians and the French, who were survivors of the communist indoctrination sessions, began to use the newly learned science against each other. And when it seemed that the French people at home refused to accept the idea of yet another 2 decades of counterinsurgency in Algeria, those deeply dedicated officers decided to apply Mao Zedong to their own country. But they had misread Mao Zedong. The French officers who had joined what was called for a while the Secret Army Organization, OAS, had mistaken 1 million frightened French Europeans living in Algeria for the kind of mass population necessary to support a revolutionary warfare operation. They forgot that, in Algeria, 9 million Muslims would not support them, and that in France, there were 48 million Frenchmen who did not share their ideas. But before they were defeated for a second time, they had almost engulfed France in the kind of revolutionary war about which they had learned in the camps east of Dien Bien Phu. The Escapees. While 10,000 prisoners marched westward away from Dien Bien Phu, a handful, 78 to be exact, clawed their way through the jungle to freedom. Their experience showed conclusively that, if one wishes to escape from the enemy in Indochina, one is better off being a native, and preferably from the area itself. Of the total number of escapees, there were only 19 Europeans. Of the Asians, 12 of the 14 NCOs were tribal Thai, and of the 40 enlisted men, 32 were tribesmen. That is, they blended in perfectly with the surrounding population. The other 8 non-Europeans were lowland Vietnamese. The European escapees were an even more curious lot. Only one single officer made a successful escape, although several others tried it. It was the indomitable Lieutenant Makoviak of 3rd BT. Makoviak had fought with the paratroopers on Elion to the last day, but when they were about to be overrun, he decided that there was still a chance to survive and fight again. Speaking perfectly the tribal Thai language, he did not find it difficult, in the chaos of the camp's conquest, to slip through the enemy lines and to begin his trek westward. On May 31st, somewhat the worse for wear, but in fighting shape, Makoviak ran into one of the French guerrilla units operating in nearby Laos. The other French escapees were even more surprising, for they included, above all, combat engineers from the 31st Battalion and tank crews. There were also some foreign legionnaires, almost all of them from Isabel, but only a very few paratroopers succeeded in breaking out. This was probably due to the fact that they were more heavily guarded than most other prisoners, and because they had been in constant heavy combat throughout the battle and were therefore in bad physical shape to resist the extreme hazards of an escape. There may well have been hundreds of men who tried to flee the marching columns, and who no doubt were captured or killed by greedy tribesmen desirous to collect a bounty from the Viet Minh or to ingratiate themselves with them. Many others probably died of exhaustion somewhere in the jungle without ever having been heard from again. The men who beyond a doubt fared best in the escape from Dien Bien Phu were the tank crews from Isabel. They stayed together throughout the escape, French and Vietnamese alike, helping each other and, even though none of them had had any jungle training, came through with flying colors. On May 10th, a small but still armed troop encountered an enemy patrol but succeeded in shaking it off at the price of leaving one prisoner, Gunner Balcon, in Viet Minh hands. Reinforced by a few legionnaires from Isabel, they continued in a southwesterly direction, only to be intercepted again on May 13th by a new Viet Minh force. In the ensuing firefight, they lost part of their men, but Sergeants Ray and Thai, Corporals Gung, Talmont, and Menet, and Vietnamese Private Van Thu, again succeeded in breaking through. They finally reached Mayo tribal villages. The Mayos, unlike the Thais, were hostile to the Viet Minh. The Mayos helped them find rafts and even gave them armed escorts, and by the end of May, the survivors of the armored platoon reached Muang Sai. They had covered 160 kilometers on foot in 20 days. Two other sergeants, Villers and Ney, from the tank squadron at the main position, managed to escape from the column of prisoners along Road 41 on May 14th. Ney, as we have seen earlier, had been wounded at Dien Bien Phu, but nevertheless preferred to attempt the escape rather than rot in a prison camp. For 7 days they marched by themselves in a vast northeasterly arc around the valley of Dien Bien Phu, until, on May 21st, they met a small group of combat engineers at the village of Hoi Cong, hard on the border between Vietnam and Laos, overlooking the Nam Nua River, which they knew would guide them to freedom. Their meeting with the engineers resulted in one of the more spectacular escapes from Dien Bien Phu. The engineers had been ordered to stay on at Dien Bien Phu to provide for essential technical services in the camp. The Viet Minh had at first ordered them to march on into the prison camps, but as early as May 9th, the communists became aware of the fact that they could not, without grave risk, demine the valley without having recourse to specialists. Master Sergeants Ryback and Cable and Sergeants Jortel and Leroy volunteered for the job, which permitted them to circulate in many areas of the camp. On May 13th, the engineers were informed that their mission had been fulfilled and that they would continue to follow the prisoner of war trek on the following day. As far as the engineers knew, their best chance of escaping was about to disappear. Fortunately, Master Sergeant Ryback had found that day a good French army road map among the debris, and one of the other sergeants had stolen some biscuits and combat rations elsewhere. At 0200 of May 14th, the four men disappeared westward into the hills. 6 days later, the small group had reached a village named Bon Loi, not to be confused with a locality of the same name near Dien Bien Phu, located about 30 kilometers southwest of Dien Bien Phu on the Nam Yum. To their horror, they found what appeared to be a Viet Minh soldier in the village, but he turned out to be a Laotian recruit in the Viet Minh forces who was not at all eager to engage the French in a fight, and who sold them fish and rice and showed them the path to Hoi Cong. On May 21st, they arrived at Hoi Cong, only to find Vierre, Ney, and a Foreign Legion paratrooper named Horst Kleinitz, as well as a few Thai tribal soldiers, under the guard of one lone Viet Minh regular armed with a French M-80-49 submachine gun. The Viet Minh motioned the engineers to sit down and eat with him and the prisoners. That good deed did him no good, because the Frenchman, after the meal, jumped their guard, knocked him out, and took his Tommy gun. From then on, they took no chances. Leaving the Nam Nua Valley, they struck out straight west through the jungle, crossed another tributary of the Nam Nua, and attempted to bypass the Thai tribal villages, known to be occupied by sympathizers of the Viet Minh, in the hope of finding Mayo villages, known to be friendly to the French. But late on May 22nd, at Hoi Vong, 70 kilometers northwest of Dien Bien Phu, they were seen by local inhabitants, and soon two Viet Minh soldiers armed with a rifle and a Tommy gun came running after them. The French wounded both men and took their weapons, but they were exhausted. Very fortunately, they came upon a small Mayo hamlet, where they found a former soldier from the 6th Laotian Infantry Battalion, who warned them from entering nearby Muang Khoa, which had again fallen to the Viet Minh, and told them to strike out for Muang Sai. There was no doubt but that Muang Sai still was in French hands, but it was almost 150 kilometers away, and each one of those kilometers was covered with high stand jungle, and most areas were overrun with communist patrols or hostile Thai tribesmen. Ryback and the other men set out for Muang Sai via the brutally difficult paths where the ridge-running Mayos live. On May 26th, the escapees crossed the Nam Hu. There, a former Laotian soldier promised them to take them to Muang Sai for a sum of 3,000 piastres, then about $90, of which they were to pay him one half immediately and one half on arrival. But as was often the case, the tribesman was not too sure of his road and also took fright at being caught with French troops. He marched with them for 2 days, but then abandoned them at the Mayo village of Lai Chak. By now, most of the escapees had reached the end of their physical tether. Their clothes were in rags, and most of them had lost or worn out their shoes. The only ones who felt capable of continuing the march were Ryback and Villers, who decided to continue towards Muang Sai. The Mayos treated the remaining French very well, and on May 31st, Sergeants Cable, Jortel, and Leroy felt well enough to continue in the direction of Muang Sai with the help of two Mayo guides. Sergeant Ney and PFC Kinitz, however, were too ill to continue with them. On June 1st, the sergeants crossed the Nam Pak and knew now that they were only about 2 days' march away from Muang Sai. Unless they were completely out of luck now, they were absolutely sure of reaching safety. Here and there, indeed, the presence of the French already made itself felt. Local villagers would confirm that French patrols had been seen recently, and also one could hear an occasional drone of a French transport or reconnaissance aircraft. Finally, at 15:30 of June 3rd, the characteristic flub-flub of helicopter rotors could be heard, and above them appeared an American-built H-19 helicopter of the French Air Force, piloted by Lieutenant Blouin. Waving wildly and screaming at the top of their lungs, although it was certain that the pilot could not hear them over the noise of his machine, the sergeants attempted to follow the path of the helicopter. It seemed not to have seen them, but suddenly it stood still in mid-air, and then began to lose altitude slowly in a cloud of churned-up leaves and dust. A few hours later, the rest of the group was picked up. Untrained and unequipped for jungle warfare, Master Sergeant Ryback and his men had covered almost 200 kilometers in less than 3 weeks. In addition, Sergeant Ney had managed to take along with him his camera, and thus became the only Frenchman to have brought out of a battle photographs of Dien Bien Phu's agony and of the escape itself. Ironically, Le Monde of May 27, 1954, had listed all of them as confirmed prisoners. Other escapees had different experiences. Gunner Georges Nallet, of the 35th Airborne Artillery, escaped from his POW column during the night of May 15th and walked westward until he reached the Nam Yuk, 30 kilometers north of Dien Bien Phu. He built a bamboo raft and paddled up the Nam Yuk in a southwesterly direction. On May 21st, he came upon a friendly Mayo village, and the tribesmen guided him from village to village until on May 24th, Nallet came upon 4 sergeants, including Sentignac from Bijard's own 6th BPC. They were taking the northernmost route to Muang Sai, but were totally unimpressed by the 200-kilometer-long trek that was ahead. They deliberately rested for 2 weeks, reconnoitering the area in which they were, and then, on June 8th, began the march southward. They were picked up without the slightest hitch by a French helicopter on July 2nd. Sergeant Sentignac was in such good shape that he refused to be evacuated, preferring to stay with a Maquis force of Mayo tribesmen. Sentignac survived the Indochina War with 7 wounds, 13 citations for bravery, and was knighted in the Legion of Honor. And when Bijard received the command of a Marine parachute regiment in Algeria, Sentignac again served with him. Master Sergeant Sentignac was killed on November 21, 1957, at Timimoun, at the edge of the Sahara, in a firefight with Bedouin tribesmen loyal to the cause of Algerian nationalism. "Of all of us," Colonel Bijard was to say of him, "it was he who had the greatest amount of luck, for he succeeded in dying the way he should have after having led the tormented life that he had chosen." The Asians among the escapees obviously blended in better with the environment and therefore stood a better chance of getting away. Thus, 2 Vietnamese corporals and 2 Thai tribesmen corporals, instead of marching into Laos, resolutely struck out for the Red River Delta and reached it without trouble by July 10th. One can imagine the utter amazement of the post commander of Vinh Yenh as Corporals Hoang Van Thuyet and Duong Van Nien reported to him after crossing almost 300 kilometers of solidly held enemy territory. PFC Tra Non of 2nd Company, 8th Parachute Assault, escaped on May 11th along with a master sergeant, a corporal, and 6 Vietnamese paratroopers. Surprised by the Viet Minh on May 16th at a watering point 10 kilometers north of Dien Bien Phu, Tra Non and 1 paratrooper escaped, but now stayed away from all villages. They marched for 5 days without food until they found a tribesman who sold them 2 pounds of rice for 600 piastres, $18, and indicated to them a friendly Mayo village 6 days' march away. They arrived in a state of total exhaustion, but were lucky enough to be picked up at the beginning of June by a French-led Maquis force. And finally, there was the case of Sergeant Hoang Van Thieng. Thieng was an interpreter with French intelligence, and the Viet Minh understandably were far from tender with any intelligence personnel. As soon as it was evident, on May 7th, that Dien Bien Phu would fall, Thieng and his other associates had dressed in Thai tribal clothing in the hopes of being mistaken for local tribesmen cut off inside the fortress. To add to his camouflage, Thieng had taken along on his flight one of the Laotian women who had been the wife of a dead tribal soldier, and both had begun the long trek westward. But the Laotian woman was simply not up to the rigors of the march through rivers and across mountains with little, if any, food. She grew weaker and weaker, and one day could go on no longer. But by then, Sergeant Tiang was certain that he had reached friendly territory and that he no longer needed the Laotian woman as a camouflage. He left her to die and reached Muang Sai a few days later without trouble. And there was Sergeant Beguin, who had been a private on January 4th, a corporal on March 1st, and a sergeant on May 1st, and who had been wounded twice in the cesspool of Strongpoint Weem. He had escaped on May 8th and had walked for 19 days by himself southwestward in the direction of the Mekong. He almost made it, but on May 28th he was captured by the Viet Minh only 80 kilometers from Luang Prabang. He weighed exactly 81 pounds when he was turned over to the French by his captors on August 26th, 1954. The dead. The bodies of about 8,000 Viet Minh troops and of over 2,000 French Union troops are buried in the reddish earth of the valley of Dien Bien Phu. But no imposing monument, either French or Viet Minh, honors the 10,000 men who died here, and who may have done more to shape the fate of the world than the soldiers at Agincourt, Waterloo, or Stalingrad. To be sure, there is a small Vietnam People's Army cemetery with about 500 bodies at the foot of Elian, and there are two small monuments, one on Beatrice and the other on ill-fated Elian II. The one on Elian is placed at the foot of the still-surviving banyan tree. But the French cemetery, bulldozed out near Dr. Groin's hospital, and used as long as burying one body did not cost two more lives, has disappeared altogether under a succession of monsoon floods and tropical underbrush. The crosses, for there had been crosses planted on the graves at least during the earlier part of the battle, and later there had been short stakes with at least a scrawled army serial number, have been slowly used up for firewood by the local population, not as a gesture of hatred, but simply as a matter of convenience. In a strange way, the dead of Dien Bien Phu were the first victims of the Second Indochina War. The ceasefire agreement signed in July 1954 at Geneva provided that both sides would be authorized to use graves registration teams in each other's zone for the purpose of regrouping the war dead in appropriate cemeteries. A special accord was signed later, which provided for the creation of permanent cemeteries by both sides in both South and North Vietnam. For Dien Bien Phu, Accord No. 24 provided for the creation of a vast ossuary, a charnel house, in the valley. The French, in view of the technical means available to them, also undertook to regroup the enemy bodies which they would find in the valley, just as the vast Verdun cemeteries in France provide an honorable resting place for the enemy also. In May 1955, exactly 1 year after the end of the battle, the North Vietnamese authorities permitted Captain Paul Belmont of the French Army and Lieutenant Nguyen Van Sai of the South Vietnamese Army to return to Dien Bien Phu and to begin there the preliminary registration and surveys necessary for the regroupment of the tombs. At that time, the traces of the battle were still fresh, and with the help of information provided them by the surviving French unit commanders, the two officers were able to identify 639 graves very rapidly. With the help of local labor provided them by the adversary, the two officers began to lay the groundwork for an ossuary that would contain 5,000 bodies. For a while, it seemed as if the battlefield of Dien Bien Phu would, thanks to the understanding of the People's Army High Command and the devotion of the French, take on the aspect of a hallowed ground, as befits a place where the fate of one nation and the world role of another had been forever shaped. But a new spirit now reigned in Saigon, where the newly divided but fully independent South Vietnamese state had taken form. Its leader, Ngo Dinh Diem, whose government had not signed the Geneva ceasefire, unilaterally decided that Viet Minh graves registration missions would not be authorized to circulate in South Vietnam, and that the cemeteries of their forces and the monuments erected to honor their dead would be razed. This was but a minor violation among the many violations of the ceasefire provisions that both sides were guilty of, and which were to lead to the Second Indochina War. With total predictability, the North Vietnamese immediately used Saigon's action to deny the French graves registration team the right to continue its work in the valley. Thus, the 10,000 dead of Dien Bien Phu were left to rot just as they had fought and died, inside or in front of the shattered bunkers on Beatrice, around the trench lines and the fort of Gabriel, on the nipple-like protrusions of breast-shaped Dominique, on the slopes and in the crater of Elian, the collapsed dugouts of the subway, the swampy lowlands of Huguette, Claudine, and Isabelle, the gun pits of the artillery, and the smashed cockpits of the downed aircraft. Most of the French dead are, like royalty, swathed in silk shrouds. Parachute nylon, like courage, was one of the common items at Dien Bien Phu, and on both sides. When Jules Rah remarked to General Giap in 1962 that something should have been done for the fallen in the valley, the Communist Commander-in-Chief promised that an effort would be made to gather the French dead and that the French would be authorized to erect a monument in their honor. Nothing has come of it, but Giap may yet make good on his promise, after the end of the Second Indochina War. 12. Epilogue. As in most lost battles, the most fascinating part of the struggle for Dien Bien Phu is the series of might-have-beens, which can be derived from the reports of the surviving senior officers. Each one of them seems to feel that a particular deficiency in logistical support or a minor tactical error constituted the decisive blunder which finally doomed Dien Bien Phu. In addition, there are the myths promulgated by outside observers. One of the most common is that the French didn't know what they were doing, for example, that their intelligence was faulty. As we have seen, the French high command knew within 10% what the enemy's infantry strength was going to be. Another widely accepted myth keeps referring to the 17 battalions of French infantry faced by 40,000 men altogether. As was shown earlier, four battalions disappeared from the battle map inside of 48 hours, 313 Foreign Legion, 3rd BT, and for all practical purposes, 2nd BT, and the 5.7 Algerian Rifles, and the airborne replacements were fed in under strength and piecemeal over a period of 3 months. 17 battalions passed through Dien Bien Phu, but there never were more than 10 deployed simultaneously. On the other hand, the Viet Minh maintained an almost constant strength of 4 divisions in the battle area. Lastly, there is the myth of Dien Bien Phu as a German battle, in which the Germans were said to have, indeed, made up nearly half the French forces. On March 12, 1954, the day before the battle began in earnest, there was a total of 2,969 Foreign Legionnaires in the fortress, out of a garrison of 10,814. Of the almost 4,300 parachuted reinforcements, a total of 962 belonged to the Foreign Legion. Even if one wrongly assumes there were important Spanish and Eastern European elements among the legionnaires at Dien Bien Phu, that 50% of the legionnaires were German, then only 1,900 men out of more than 15,000 who participated in the battle could have been of German origin. But old myths, particularly when reinforced by prejudice, die hard. The Viet Minh, however, far exceeded French intelligence estimates in the number of artillery pieces and artillery shells which they succeeded in bringing to the valley. Each Viet Minh infantry regiment was known to possess one battery of 4 75mm mountain howitzers and one battery of 4 120mm heavy mortars. It was also known that the 301st Division could field 3 artillery battalions of 105mm composed of 3 batteries of 4 field guns each. In reality, there were 144 field pieces available to the enemy at Dien Bien Phu, not including at least 30 75mm recoilless cannon, some 36 heavy flak pieces, and, in the last few days of the battle, between 12 to 16 of the 6-tube Katyusha rocket launchers. A more fateful error in French intelligence estimates occurred when the Deuxième Bureau estimated the Viet Minh's artillery ammunition capability at a total of 25,000 rounds, and counted on the French Air Force to prevent further sizable amounts of ammunition from reaching the battlefield. While some of the Viet Minh ammunition figures cited later reached an unbelievable level of 350,000 rounds, it seems clearly established from French artillery observations that the enemy fired a total of 103,000 shells of 75mm caliber or bigger, of which a depressing 12,000 were misdropped French-American supply loads. For comparison, the French more or less wasted 38,500 shells during the pre-siege period of November 1953 to March 13, 1954, and they fired a total of 93,000 shells of similar caliber during the period of actual battle. The French, to be sure, were outgunned 3-1 on the ground, but possessed airborne firepower and 10 tanks. It is therefore not quite accurate to say that the French lost Dien Bien Phu simply because they had placed themselves in an area where the enemy's firepower far outclassed them. There were many things that went wrong at Dien Bien Phu. The imbalance in firepower between the two adversaries was not the worst of them. On the other hand, there can be no doubt that the French completely lost the logistical battle. They proved incapable, and in this there was a terribly important lesson for the Americans who fought in Vietnam in 1965-67, of interdicting the flow of communist supplies in the valley. The Viet Minh had at its disposal a total of 600 Russian Molotova 2.5-ton trucks, for which barely passable roads and river ferries had to be built by tens of thousands of coolies. But the mainstay of the supply system were the tough, bicycle-pushing human supply columns. Carrying often 200 kilos, 440 pounds of supplies on a standard bicycle whose seat had been replaced by a short holding stick and whose handlebar had been extended by another stick, permitting the vehicle to be easily guided even when heavily loaded, 8,286 tons had been shipped over 600 miles of jungle from China to Dien Bien Phu, 4,620 tons of petrol products, 1,360 tons of ammunition, 46 tons of spare weapons, and 2,260 tons of consumable goods, including 1,700 tons of rice, of which 400 were eaten by the carrier columns on the trek. In contrast to what goes on in the Second Indochina War, where the Ho Chi Minh Trail does not start at any one particular place, and above all, does not end at any one particular point, as was the case of the supply system at Dien Bien Phu, the French Air Force was in a position to concentrate its supply interdiction effort upon a relatively well-known and fairly well-circumscribed route. Its failure to hamper communist supply operations in any significant manner surely was in part due to the small amount of aircraft and bomb tonnage that could be spared by the pitifully small French Air Force for this work. But it must be remembered that, barely a year earlier, the mighty United States Far Eastern Air Force, FEAF, had also failed to bring the Red Chinese and North Korean supply systems to their knees, despite the fact that hundreds of American heavy and medium bombers were engaged in a year-long, round-the-clock interdiction effort dubbed Operation Strangle. On the French side, estimates of supplies parachuted on Dien Bien Phu from March 13th to May 7th varied from 6,410 to 6,900 tons, and daily figures from 117 tons to 123 tons, but actually received usable supplies reduced this to about 100 tons per day. While this was not enough, it was a great deal more than any besieged fortress had received during World War II, from Corregidor to Stalingrad. In fact, in its post-mortem on the battle, Quartermaster asked whether, in the last analysis, the real bottleneck was not more in the primitive supply collection capability of the besieged fortress than in the limited amount of supplies it received. That point warrants closer examination, as similar situations are likely to recur in other wars of this type. Considering the ever-shrinking size of the defense perimeter, and therefore the extremely limited amount of usable airspace above the fortress that was available for supply drops, it would have at first glance seemed wise to drop the largest possible loads from the largest available plane. However, it is perfectly obvious that, with the increase of well-aimed artillery fire over the whole surface of the fortress, it became impossible to move even electric field generators weighing 1 ton, let alone single 5-ton pallet loads, which the flying boxcars could have easily handled. Dien Bien Phu was caught in a vicious circle, in which the maintenance of wider supply drop zones would have required the presence of larger troop reserves, and in which the presence of larger troop reserves would have required a further upward spiraling of supply requirements. But here we now come to the more important variables of the might-have-been Battle of Dien Bien Phu. There had been inside Dien Bien Phu at least 3,000 to 4,000 internal deserters, tribesmen, Vietnamese, North Africans, and also some Frenchmen and foreign legionnaires, who decided to sit out the battle in the rat holes along the banks of the Nam Yum. 10 years later, Colonel Bijard still believed that with the same number of troops that were available at Dien Bien Phu, but of first-class quality, the French could have survived the battle. "If you had given me 10,000 SS troopers," said Bijard to this writer 10 years after the battle, "we'd have held out." Here, it is impossible to absolve General René Coigny, the French commander of North Vietnam, of responsibility. As we have seen, he had never been enthusiastic about the idea of Dien Bien Phu, and he considered the Red River Delta, with the core cities of Hanoi and Haiphong, its 3 million tons of rice and 9 million people, far more vital to the French cause than the forlorn valley at the very periphery of his command. he had been reluctant to deprive himself of his best troops and best commanders for the sake of strengthening Dien Bien Phu, and had repeatedly underlined to General Navarre that the Battle of Dien Bien Phu had to be conducted at the level of the whole Indochina theater, rather than at that of Tonkin alone. The available evidence does not show that General de Castries was particularly aware of his own personnel problem, or even alarmed by it. At first, as long as Dien Bien Phu was to remain a mooring point for offensive operations deep into the Thai highland jungle, there was ample justification to keep the Thai tribal units around, even if they were of dubious fighting value. As for the North Africans, many of the French officers, including de Castries and Longley, had commanded them in the past and prided themselves in knowing them well. The North Africans had fought well for France for 100 years, and they had fought well elsewhere in Indochina. There was no reason to believe that they would crack now. But crack they did, simply because it had been a terribly long and bloody war, and they were tired of it. It was a war very far away from home, and they had been frequently the object of intensive propaganda, appealing to them to quit fighting France's colonial wars. Many of the surviving senior commanders at Dien Bien Phu argued bitterly that an additional group of 2 good battalions could surely have saved Strongpoints Gabriel and Anne-Marie in mid-March, both of which covered the vital airfield, and that even 1 reserve battalion available on March 30th could have retaken Dominique's 1 and 2 from a stunned enemy and held them just as long as Elian, thus covering the center of Dien Bien Phu from flat trajectory fire. In their report, the survivors of the armored squadron argued that a full-strength unit of 17 tanks instead of 10 could easily have maintained communications with Isabelle and Gabriel. No one thought much, apparently, of outlying Beatrice, which probably should never have been occupied to begin with, could easily have retaken Dominique too and protected the airstrip, and could have, as the Americans often did in Korea and in the Philippines against the Japanese, been used in close combat against the entrenched communist artillery. Veritable hunter-killer teams could have been organized with a combination of tanks and dive bombers to hunt down communist battery positions. As the successful breakout of March 28th showed, such well-coordinated stabs could have destroyed much of the feared light enemy flak that hampered the supply drops so much and rapidly made the airfield unusable. Whether such an enlarged tank squadron would really have tilted the balance of the defensive battle may well remain one of the most tantalizing might-have-beens of the whole struggle for the valley. Another failure, and it seems to have been both a French and American failure, was the total underestimation of the enemy's anti-aircraft gunmanship. Since the Korean War had ended only a few months before the battle for Dien Bien Phu began, it probably was impossible by then to fully evaluate the deadly effectiveness of flak there, which finally accounted for 816 kills as against 147 Allied planes lost in air-to-air combat. And in Korea, as was to be the case at Dien Bien Phu, the flak suppression strikes usually drove enemy gunners under cover, but seldom destroyed enemy weapons. Yet the myth that conventional light flak and even a fire curtain of massed small arms could not seriously hurt high-performance aircraft was so strongly anchored in the minds of American air power strategists that as late as 1962, addressing themselves to the new Vietnam problem, they strongly affirmed that jungle rebels are not equipped with ACAC or interception capability, so that air superiority is practically assured. Recent aircraft losses over Vietnam have probably disabused them of that notion. But in 1953-54, the French fully believed their American teachers. They paid for that error with a total of 48 aircraft shot down over the valley, another 14 destroyed on the ground at Dien Bien Phu, and 167 damaged over the valley by enemy flak. Considering that these losses were inflicted in 5 months upon an air force which never had more than 100 supply and reconnaissance aircraft and 75 combat aircraft available for Dien Bien Phu, they were extremely heavy. Dien Bien Phu, like almost all other besieged fortresses, eventually died from its supply deficiencies. This book clearly shows several instances in which successful counterattacks were interrupted because there was no ammunition available to sustain them. In the end, the Alliance, which had weathered every enemy infantry assault, weeks of intensive artillery bombardment, and even underground mining, finally fell because their garrisons had run out of ammunition. If any particular group of enemy soldiers should be considered indispensable to victory, then it must be the Viet Minh anti-aircraft gunners and their Chinese instructors. When everything has been said about the many major and minor errors which led to the French debacle at Dien Bien Phu, the poorly planned counterattacks, the flimsily built field fortifications, the underestimation of the enemy flak, and even the choice of the battle area itself, one single fact stands out above all others. Air power on a more massive scale than was then available could not have changed the outcome of the Indochina War, but it would have saved Dien Bien Phu. French observers of the battle, regardless of their own service loyalties, appear to be in agreement on this. The chairman of the French Government Investigating Commission on the Battle of Dien Bien Phu, Army General Catrou, was to say later, and there is little question that his statement reflects the general tenor of the still top-secret report, that the sole chance of salvation of the heroic garrison rested on a massive intervention of a fleet of American bombers, based both on aircraft carriers of the U.S. Navy and in the Philippines. Undertaken by some 300 to 400 heavy aircraft, that operation would have, in the view of the experts, smashed the Viet Minh siege organizations and would doubtlessly have reversed the course of events. At a press conference held by General de Castries upon his return from captivity, the commander of the fallen fortress also declared that a massive American air intervention would have, in all likelihood, permitted him to retake the initiative. And finally, General Ely, who succeeded Navarre after the latter had been relieved from command and who is known to this day as one of the most pro-American of all French senior officers, judged the role of the lack of air power at the crucial moment in the following terms. "I truly believe that, had I been commander-in-chief at the time, I would not have made the same decision as General Navarre, but I would be quite incapable of saying today what would then have happened to the situation in Laos and in Tonkin. On the other hand, had, by some unexpected chance, which often plays a decisive role in war, Dien Bien Phu not fallen, if only the fortress had been disengaged from enemy encirclement by American aerial intervention, would not then the choice made by Navarre be considered to this day as a stroke of genius, and wouldn't those who have condemned him since attempt to share with him in the authorship of the operation?" These various viewpoints give rise to two additional questions. One, why did France herself not provide her armed forces in Indochina with an adequate air force? Two, why did the United States, knowing full well what was at stake, fail to provide the lacking air power after all? As shown earlier, the answer to the first question goes back in part to the whole French military structure after World War II. France, defeated and occupied by the Germans from 1940 to 1944, had built up a free French air force in Great Britain, North Africa, and Italy, and eventually even in Russia, which included, as its mainstay, 330 American light and medium bombers, the largest type being the B-26, and 723 American-built fighters. To this force must be added a few Free French squadrons armed with British Spitfires and two fighter groups operating on the Russian front with Soviet-built Stormoviks. When the Indochina War began, it was at first thought to be of the classical colonial kind, and thus only transport planes and a few fighter squadrons were assigned to it. When it became obvious that bombers would be required, it turned out that France's mission within the new NATO structure did not provide for the building up of a specifically French bomber force, but assigned to France an exclusively passive role in the field of tactical support and air defense. In fact, during the early years of NATO, only the United States and Britain possessed bomber forces. With the exception of two French Navy squadrons of four-engine privateers, the French did not even possess any aircraft capable of providing a training nucleus for heavy bomber crews. In that particular sense, and the argument is now often invoked by French officials opposed to the subordination of French national interests to the overall requirements of the NATO alliance, the very modernization of the French fighter force within NATO to an all-jet force prevented the use of that force in Indochina, since there were practically no airfields available in that country which were capable of providing for the efficient maintenance of a large jet force. It took the incredibly huge American military and industrial deployment of 1965 to 66 to provide South Vietnam alone with that kind of infrastructure. In addition, even the senior French officials involved admit that both the military and the French government of the time had made some crucial mistakes. On the military side, the importance of bombers in that kind of war had been grossly underestimated until very late, and the use of jets had been considered, in view of their high speed, as totally uneconomical, if not unfeasible. Édouard Frédéric Dupont, a longtime French conservative member of parliament and minister for the Associated States of Indochina during the crucial 1954 period, later accused the French military of both tactical blindness and excessive timidity in stating their requirements. 4 years had to go by before it was understood that this sort of war required riverboats and helicopters. Heavy bomber aircraft, whose lack resulted in the defeat of Dien Bien Phu, had never been requested by the responsible authorities from the legislators who went on missions to Indochina. And when we finally got aircraft, it was found that the necessary training fields and repair crews were lacking. While that assertion no doubt contains a large grain of truth, General Charles Lauzanne, the commander of the French Far Eastern Air Force at the time of the Battle of Dien Bien Phu, in his first top-secret sum-up of the battle, was to remind his superiors in France that he had reported the serious deficiencies in aircraft and Air Force personnel prevailing in Indochina as soon as he had taken over his Indochina command on June 30, 1953, and that the French Parliament had turned down a modest $18.4 million budget request for airfield construction and improvement in Indochina for the fiscal year 1953-54. The net result of that combination of French errors of judgment and conflicting NATO obligations was that the French were unable to deploy fully the obsolete aircraft which became available to them through last-minute intensive American aid. In addition, and that was also the price the French now had to pay for their own defeat in World War II, there were very few French senior officers who had had sufficient command experience to make intelligent use of the available air power. This was clearly felt by the air commanders in Indochina. General Lucien Max Chassin, Lauzanne's predecessor, wrote in his own end-of-mission report of June 14, 1953, that is, 6 months before the beginning of the Battle of Dien Bien Phu, that the French High Command in Indochina, which was totally dominated by ground force officers, regularly committed two capital errors in the use of its aviation. One was that aircraft were always requested on a piecemeal basis, with the result that every ground commander finally operated with his own personal air force, and the other was that neither the Air Force nor the Navy ever actually participated in the overall planning of the war itself. Just as the French had not known how to use their tanks in 1940, they did not know how to use their air force in 1954. A good part of the reason why Dien Bien Phu was lost lies right there. But even so, less than 100 combat aircraft, no matter how well deployed and how aggressively used and led, could not have changed the fate of the Indochina War or even of the Valley of Dien Bien Phu. A small comparison with the situation prevailing in Korea from 1950 to 1953 and during the Second Indochina War in 1965-66 make this abundantly clear. In Korea, by July 1953, the United States Far Eastern Air Force had jurisdiction over 1,536 American and Allied aircraft. By mid-1966, the United States had deployed for use in Vietnam approximately 1,700 helicopters, most of them armed, about 700 fixed-wing support aircraft, transports and reconnaissance planes, 400 U.S. Navy combat planes, and about 1,000 U.S. Air Force combat aircraft in the country itself. To those aircraft must be added the 400-plane Vietnam Air Force and 35 Royal Laotian Air Force aircraft, the latter operating against communist supply lines crossing Laotian territory. In addition, close to 90 heavy B-52 bombers support the Vietnam War from their base in Guam. What this means in terms of actual performance can be easily guessed at. Throughout the total of 167 days of the siege of Dien Bien Phu from November 20, 1953 to May 8, 1954, a total of 10,400 air missions were flown in behalf of Dien Bien Phu. Of those, 6,700 were supply or troop transport missions, and 3,700 were combat missions. Of the latter, 1,267 were flown by the French Navy. At the beginning of 1966, the weekly sorties flown by American aircraft in Vietnam often exceeded the 25,000 mark. One single example from the Indochina War clearly illustrates what can be done when air power is available in well-nigh unlimited quantities. During the battle around the totally unimportant Special Forces camp at Plymé, a triangular mud fort manned by 300 mountain tribesmen and 12 Americans, friendly combat aircraft flew 240 sorties a day. The Nguyen Phu, with its 15,000 men, considered itself extremely fortunate if a total of 40 combat missions were flown in any 24-hour period. The question, then, arises as to whether a major American air effort around Dien Bien Phu in 1954 would have achieved a desirable military result, and hence, a worthwhile political result at Geneva. The answer is yes. For example, the incredible saturation of American air power in South Vietnam in 1965-66 saved American and Vietnamese troops from disaster on several occasions when they were being badly mauled by far more battle-experienced and jungle-wise South Vietnamese Viet Cong or North Vietnamese People's Army troops. Even in the restricted field of aerial supply, an enlarged American effort of limited proportions would have permitted the simultaneous maintenance of Dien Bien Phu's supply levels and the adequate reinforcement of Colonel de Crevecoeur's Condor Force, clawing its way through the Laotian jungles in the direction of the valley. That supply force could have been American without even entangling the United States in an enlarged Indochina war. Dozens of ground actions were fought in South Vietnam in 1965-66, in which the sudden reinforcement of a position by an air-landed battalion or the near-total destruction of enemy depots by a flight of B-52s changed the issue of the local battle. One can imagine what a fleet of American B-29s could have done to the Viet Minh depot area at Tuan Giao, or to the communist artillery batteries west of Claudine, and to the hordes of Viet Minh infantry emerging out of the trenches below Dominique and Elian. 10 years later, Georges Bidault, who had been France's foreign minister at the time of Dien Bien Phu, and who now was in exile in Brazil for his subversive activities against the French government of General de Gaulle, commented acidly in his memoirs that the calculated risk policy of the late Secretary of State Dulles had been one which involved a great deal of calculation, but no risks, and that the present risks the United States now must shoulder almost alone in Vietnam come from there. While this may well be an oversimplification of the situation, there is little doubt that it was the French defeat at Dien Bien Phu which gave the whole situation in the Indochina Peninsula its especially unstable character. Other colonial nations had withdrawn from former possessions under situations of duress, and still others, including France in Algeria and Britain in Cyprus, finally evacuated colonies after fighting prolonged and bloody wars to inconclusive ends. But only at Dien Bien Phu was a colonial power recently defeated on the open field of battle by the subject nation. For the sacrifice of Dien Bien Phu did not even save the Red River Delta, which General Cogny wanted to preserve at all costs. There were enough People's Army forces left around the Delta itself to begin the dreaded counteroffensive that would deliver it to the enemy as the war's major prize. On June 28, 1954, General Ely ordered the evacuation of the whole southern part of the Red River Delta, including the two stalwart Catholic bishoprics of Phat Diem and Bui Chu. The whole French position on North Vietnam now was reduced to a narrow corridor on either side of the Hanoi-Haiphong lifeline. In South Vietnam, for the first time, the situation was also deteriorating rapidly, with Vietnamese army units deserting in many places and French hospitals overflowing with the wounded pouring in from the about-to-be-abandoned zones. Dien Bien Phu had been a Viet Minh military victory over the French, as well as a political victory over the United States. As this writer has pointed out elsewhere in great detail, American policy would have been more consistent with practical realities of the post-war era and with the long-standing ideals of anti-colonialism, which the United States has continuously professed, if at least as much pressure had been put on France to come to an early understanding with Vietnamese nationalism as was put, for example, on the Netherlands with regard to Indonesia and on Britain with regard to India. Contrary to a prevailing misunderstanding of the facts, easily cleared up by a reading of the published State Department papers of the time, that seemingly lenient policy with regard to France was due neither to excessive francophilia in the State Department nor to fears of French obstreperousness in NATO. The latter was created only in 1949, at a time when the Indochina War had already hardened into a major conflict, and the same fears of obstreperousness could have arisen in connection with Holland or Britain, but did not stop the United States, for example, from being at total loggerheads with Britain over the latter's Palestine policy. I must give credit to the noted commentator and specialist in French affairs, David Schoenbrunn, for having personally drawn my attention to the particular aspect of the Vietnam crisis which differentiates it from the other post-war decolonization wars. By the time the United States became seriously interested in the Indochina struggle, mainland China had fallen to the communists, and Washington was in frantic search of allies, any kind of allies, including the French colonials in Indochina and the British colonials in Malaysia, to man a second-line blocking position in the Far East. Secretary of State Dean Acheson's Crisis in Asia speech of January 1950 marked that change of policy from one of total aloofness from the Indochina War to one of all-out support for the French, regardless of the obvious errors of their policies. As the Korean War added its problems to the gloomy picture of the West's position in Asia, the United States further encouraged the French to commit themselves to what had now become a crusade against communism, and, in the process, committed herself increasingly to their support with money, weapons, supplies, and advisors, and, as we have seen, at the very least, with combat aircraft. That commitment was an entirely American option, in which additional commitments by other European or Australian allies played by no means an essential part, just as they did not in August 1964, when President Lyndon B. Johnson committed the United States to an open-ended defense of South Vietnam and Thailand, and perhaps the rest of Southeast Asia, regardless of the policies or attitudes of other allies. The decision then, in April 1954, to let events at Dien Bien Phu take their course, and to make any kind of American intervention the object of prior approval by other allies, was likewise unilateral. Under the circumstances, it put the United States in a position where, for the first time in her whole history, she would abandon an ally to his fate, while the ally was fighting a war that the United States had encouraged him to fight to a point far beyond his own political objectives, and most certainly far beyond his own military means. In that sense, there can be no doubt but that Dien Bien Phu, far from being a purely French defeat, became an American defeat as well. That is why the magic name of Dien Bien Phu is conjured up whenever North Vietnam is exhorted by its leaders to stand fast under the deluge of American bombs that rain down on the country. And it is Dien Bien Phu, along with Suez, which comes to the mind of French military commanders and politicians when General de Gaulle avers that, in a crisis not involving her directly, the United States cannot be counted upon with full certitude. From 1965 onward, the United States was willing to go to war for the sake of preserving what her president calls her national honor. In 1954, 100 airplanes could not be found to save 15,000 French troops at Dien Bien Phu. Even so, Dien Bien Phu played a strategically useful role for the United States. It faced her squarely with the reality that, along with the Chinese People's Army, there would now be another major communist military force in Southeast Asia. Dien Bien Phu signaled in an unequivocal manner the coming of age of the Vietnam People's Army. In doing so, it compelled the United States to make later on the choice which the Republican administration and the Democratic congressional leaders, Lyndon B. Johnson and John W. McCormick, had successfully avoided making under perhaps less unfavorable conditions in 1954. Future historians will tell whether it was necessary for the West to suffer a defeat at Dien Bien Phu in 1954 in order not to have to face one in South Vietnam in 1967, or whether, had a decisive defeat at Dien Bien Phu been avoided in 1954, Vietnam's history would have taken a less troubled course. A North Vietnamese communist state less conscious of its military superiority and a South Vietnamese state less burdened by the shadow of crushing military defeat might have been able to work out by themselves a fate which would not have led the world once more to the brink of war over Indochina. And a France, which, rightly or wrongly, would not have felt abandoned by two close allies in her direst hour of need, might well have become a stabilizing factor in the Indochina area, just as she has become one in Africa. American warplanes eventually did come to Dien Bien Phu on July 2, 1965. Exactly 11 years, 1 month, and 26 days after Brigadier General Christian Marie Ferdinand de la Croix de Castries had walked out of his bunker a prisoner. With an ear-shattering screech, 24 American jet-powered F-105 Thunder Chiefs and A-4 Skyhawks attacked a North Vietnamese military barracks area in the Dien Bien Phu Valley 3 miles to the south of the main airfield, near where Strongpoint Isabel used to be, and they also cratered the airfield and a group of 12 adjoining buildings, located just about where the French had fought for Strongpoint Opera, the nameless Strongpoint, and Sparrowhawk. The new communist airfield was longer than the one the French had built, and formed a light-angled X with the old strip, thus covering with a thick layer of concrete the dead from the Huguettes. In less than 15 minutes, the American jets expended 29 tons of 750-pound high-explosive bombs, 2.75-inch rockets, and bullpup airborne missiles on the new target. There was, as 11 years earlier, a great deal of enemy flak, but no enemy planes were sighted, and all American aircraft returned safely to their bases. The pilots who flew the mission reported that the weather had been perfectly clear that summer day over the valley. Postface. Where are they now? General Navarre retired soon after his return from Indochina, wrote a book, and was sued by General Cogny, a suit that nobody won. He now runs a brick factory on the Riviera. General Cogny, after holding a paper command for some years in Paris, retired in 1964. General de Castri for a time commanded the 5th French Armored Division in Germany, and after a car accident with his wife, retired in 1959, and now is the president of an industrial consortium for the reuse of waste paper. General Gilles, already afflicted with a heart condition when he jumped into Dien Bien Phu, died literally of a broken heart in 1961 when one of his sons was killed in Algeria. General Bo Nguyen Giap, the enemy commander at Dien Bien Phu, is now, in addition to being the commander-in-chief of the Vietnam People's Army, the Minister of Defense and Vice Premier of North Vietnam. Lang Le, now a brigadier general, commands the 20th Airborne Brigade at Pau in the Pyrenees Mountains near the Spanish border. It is part of the 11th Division Légère d'Intervention, a new French division especially designed for rapid deployment overseas. The new commander of the division is Brigadier General Lalande, the former commander of Strongpoint Isabel. The 25th Brigade of the division is commanded by Colonel Bijar, and many of the junior survivors of Dien Bien Phu still serve together 12 years later in the 11th Division. Hubert de Seguin-Pazy, Dien Bien Phu's last chief of staff, is now a brigadier general and deputy commander of the École Supérieure de Guerre, the French War College in Paris. Francard ended his military career in 1964 as subdivision commander in Marseille with the rank of brigadier general. Chanel, of 2nd VT, served under him as a colonel. Badeau, the imperturbable Foreign Legion Chief of Staff, now is the colonel commanding the 1st Foreign Legion Regiment at Aubagne, and Coldbouffe, from the 1-2 Foreign Legion Infantry, serves with him as a major. Guérin, the Air Force commander at Dien Bien Phu, in 1966 served as a colonel in the NATO Standing Group in the Pentagon in Washington. Colonel Nicot, who had commanded the air transport for the fortress and was later a major general in Algeria, served time for his involvement in an attempted anti-government putsch in 1961 until amnestied on Christmas Day, 1965. Aliou, who commanded an artillery battalion at Dien Bien Phu, now runs a cellulose factory in independent Algeria. Guerreau continued to command paratroops in Algeria, including the famous 1st Foreign Legion Parachute Regiment, dissolved in 1961 for his participation in a mutiny. It cost him his career. Lieutenant Wiem, now a major, served for a long time as military advisor to the Malagasy Republic and is currently working on a thesis on African labor unions. Sergeant Beguin, who served with him in the tribal auxiliaries, now has a trucking business in Savoy. Erwan Vergeau, whose airborne mortar company held off the Viet Minh until the end, is still a captain and works in the French Army Public Information Office, having written a book on Dien Bien Phu as seen through the eyes of a private. Roland de Mecanem and Jean Nicolas, who commanded North African battalions at Dien Bien Phu, now are instructors at senior French service schools. Bréchignac, like many of his colleagues dissatisfied with the fate of Algeria, left the army to enter business. He now runs a cement factory in Valence, north of Marseille. Touré left the army as a colonel to enter business. Major Jean Pouget, despite brilliant prospects, preferred to leave the service to write. His own book on Dien Bien Phu is excellent. Warrant Officer Franz Joseph, formerly of Claudine, now lives close to French military history as a supervisor at the Invalides Memorial where Napoleon is buried. Jean Verdi, one of the Americans who flew the boxcar missions over Dien Bien Phu, returned to the Marine Corps, where he now serves as a major with Marine Aircraft Group 12. Father Guidon, the chaplain on Isabelle, returned to his civilian missionary work and was last heard from in Ubon Ratchathani in northeastern Thailand, working among Vietnamese refugees. Dr. Groin also stayed in the Far East and now runs his own private hospital in Phnom Penh, Cambodia. Genevieve de Gallard-Teroub married an officer who had not been at Dien Bien Phu, moved with him to Madagascar, and recently returned with him and their children to France. Abderrahman Ben Salem, the Algerian master sergeant who saw the beginning of the end on top of Gabriel, is now a member of the Algerian parliament, after having fought against the French for 6 years. Mimi, her real name was Miriam, and her husband Saïd, who is now a sheet metal worker, have settled down in the Parisian working-class suburb of Aubervilliers with their two children. And there is Michel Désiré, who survived the prison camps in spite of his severe wounds, which left him too disabled for a troop command. Promoted to major, he now works at the French military archives in the Château de Vincennes near Paris. One of his main jobs is to put the Far Eastern files in good order. Dien Bien Phu is still very much with him. This concludes Hell in a Very Small Place by Bernard B. Fall, narrated by Robertson Dean. Copyright 1966 by Bernard B. Fall. This unabridged audiobook is produced by arrangement with HarperCollins Publishers and was produced in the year 2016 by Tantor Media Incorporated, a division of Recorded Books, which holds the copyright thereto.